This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. In just a moment, I will be talking to a fascinating author about a book that I think all of you will enjoy, but I want just to say one special message to George out there. He's having some surgery today, and I want him to know that I'm thinking about him and praying for him, and I'm sure everything will go just fine, but I George is one of my favorite names, and I love, I have a giraffe, a 10-foot tall giraffe, who guards my front door, and his name is George, and so I just want to say a special shout out to George, and I'm looking forward to hearing about the results of the surgery, but I think everything will be great. And I also want to say hello to my son up in, I don't know, he's going to have negative 17 degrees weather up north, and I just want to say, Come home. It's better down here. But now, whoa, this is exciting. I am going to be talking now to an author that her book is, it's fascinating, I tell you. And for all of you writers out there, it is a subject that you will want to know about. And I'm very happy, always to bring sort of a variety of authors to the program, because I never know which book will be just that book that will help you. Sometimes it's just a cozy mystery. It will fill your evening one evening, and you will say, oh, wow, I needed that book. Or it might be a thriller that will get your mind off of all the problems. Or it might be a fantasy. Or it might be a nonfiction book about a subject that is very important. And so the book today is called The Magic of Connection: Stop Cutting Cords and Learn to Transform Negative Energy to Live an Empowered Life. And of course, we all want to live an empowered life. So I'm happy to welcome Michelle Welch to Joy on Paper. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Okay. Well, a long title, but it says a lot in that title, because, of course, during these pandemic-y days, there's a lot of negative energy out there, and I'm sure everybody wants to know how to find a better solution to the problems that they might be encountering and get a better attitude. So tell us about the book, The Magic of Connection, and then we'll, I'd also like to know a little bit more about you.
Yes. Well, the book, it's interesting. I was listening to you talk about just all the different kinds of books, and I so much agree with you. I started off as just, I'm an avid reader. I read all the time. And so I feel that so much, what you were saying about all the different kinds of books that can just make us feel good. And we never know what kind of book we'll pick up. And I never thought I would write what might would fall into the maybe self-help category of books, and that's kind of where this book falls, but maybe sort of spiritual in a way also. So The Magic of Connection really came about because of everyone I just noticed coming. I own two stores in the Dallas area in Texas, and people would come in my stores, and I would hear just so much about how much negativity they were dealing with in their lives. And they would say, you know, I'm an empath. They would throw this word around because there are so many books and blogs and online quizzes about this subject of being an empath, you know, as a noun, or having empathy. And they wouldn't know what to do with it. And so they were labeled as an empath, which was helpful at first. Like, I'm an empath, so I'm really sensitive. And that would be me too, you know, really sensitive to energy. But then it got to be, I really heard a lot of it being everything they couldn't do. They couldn't go out in crowds because they couldn't handle the negativity. This is before COVID, so that example, you know, crowd. But they couldn't really handle negativity, and it was, they started becoming really fear-based. And so I started to really think about that and how people were just cutting everybody out of their life. And then it became even more so during the past year, just of people just cutting everyone out of their lives and blocking people, and I don't want to have anything to do with anybody else. And so it just evolved from that, and how we could maybe start healing the cords of connection that we have between each other and everything and everyone, and how we could transform that quote-unquote negativity and maybe start connecting again instead of building up barriers between us and everyone else.
And since we have these barriers now that everything is on Zoom, we can't have that same interaction that we would normally have. And you're right. The word empath is sort of, I noticed it coming around, you know, several years ago, people using it all the time and not understanding what it meant. I mean, we want, somebody said to me, it was something like, oh, I have this gut feeling. And I thought, well, are you Leroy Jethro Gibbs? You know, he's got gut feelings. It doesn't make him an empath. And I thought, people find NCS interesting if they had to think of Leroy Jethro Gibbs as being empathetic. But, you know, it's a difficult thing because in a way, some people think that there's some of the things that people talk about who, you know, say they are empaths are a little bit out there. And, you know, you're a lawyer, right?
I am.
Yeah, you're a lawyer. And what kind of law did you practice?
Pretty much, you name it, I practiced it. So I started off, I worked for the Court of Appeals in Texas. And right out of law school, and I graduated law school early. I was a lawyer at 24 years old. And I went straight, I did an internship for the Court of Appeals, then I went for the DA's office in downtown Dallas. Then I did criminal defense, and then I went into civil litigation and had a very successful civil litigation firm with three offices. And that is still a very, very successful firm with my ex-husband.
Well, see, I wasn't sure if you were like a public defender, and so this idea of empathy came into your life that you were, you know, you had empathy for either one way or the other, if you were a prosecutor, the victim, or the criminal. So I didn't know if it had sort of started there with you.
It was on both sides. Mine really all of this started, you know, the classic thing you hear at a young age, that empathy started, and I can talk about that, but as far as law, I had empathy, I would say, in the criminal, it started with women, domestic violence. I would put a lot of women on the stand, and they would drop charges. And so I became very involved with an organization called Genesis Women's Shelter here in Dallas. And I was a volunteer, and I have been there for over 20 years, and on and off, and on their board, and on various boards. And then as a criminal, I wasn't a public defender, but I was court-appointed by judges to do appeals and defense work. And so I saw it from a different side and saw what parents, a lot of it was that you deal a lot with the mothers of people who would be incarcerated, and you would talk to the mothers, and that really would get me as a mother, and of course the clients also. And then when I put on the kind of sold out, people would think, you know, and became the civil litigator to work just in civil litigation, you'd see a different thing, because I never did family law, I never did like personal injury. But I was representing people. You know, when you're a lawyer, you are representing people at the worst point in their life. Something really bad is going on in their life. And maybe not the worst point, but it's hard for them. And so you do have empathy. And if you don't, I don't think you're necessarily the best lawyer. You've got to understand both sides of a case to be a good lawyer, your opponent's side and your client's side of the case. But the empathy for me was from a very young age of always feeling super sensitive, and I would lean into other people's energy. I would really feel and, I believe, take on a lot of the energy of other people and feel that much more acutely than maybe other people would. I remember one time my mom telling me, you know, Michelle, they're not thinking about you as much as you think they are. I worried so much what everyone else thought because I would feel their energy. I could walk in a room and pretty much know what other people were feeling. And most of the time be pretty accurate and lean into others' energy. And it's not always people. It can be things, too. It can be the earth. It can be feeling into what the earth or the ocean or animals. But at some point, authors, a lot of them, used the, it became common vernacular in these books to use empath as a noun. And it became accepted to call people an empath. And my book goes beyond that because I read book after book after book. And I, as many as like, if there's one out there that I haven't read, it's because it hasn't come out yet. As many as I can find and get my hands on, because all these books told me what an empath is, but it didn't really teach me or other empaths how to be an empath. It told us how to hide as an empath, and they didn't truly empower us, in my opinion, like they said they were going to do. They didn't tell us how to change energy. They just told us how to kind of hide from it or protect from it, not to how to change the form of it. And so it sounds woo-woo, but really it's the law of the universe. I mean, everything's energy. It's thermodynamics. There's a limited amount of it. It never goes away. So you can change the form of energy. And so that's what I talk about in the book.
Now, they have an acronym for everything, and I know that highly emphatic people are now called HEPS, H-E-P-S. Mm-hmm. So when they talk about that, often HEPS, people with empath, want to, you know, can't be in crowds. Did you find that as a young person when you were young? Did it overwhelm you?
That was one of the things, that's one of the things on the checklist of the can't, like I was referring to. So that wasn't as much mine, the crowds. Because mine also has a lot of the intuitive knowingness along with being an empath. For me, I would tend to pick up on thoughts and things like that too. But I didn't, mine was more the, it wasn't the crowds as so much as, I get that because that is for a lot of people. That is one of the big, I'd say if you had 7 to 10 things that you listed, that would definitely be one of them. Not so much for me, but for most people. And they will say, you know, I just can't pick up on all that energy. It just overwhelms me. But the key word for me is that can't, because that's what started bothering me when people would come in my stores. I'm an empath. I can't. I'm an empath. I can't. I can't be around crowds. I can't be around her negativity. I can't be around this. And I found it was almost a crutch to not manage and mind our own energy first, to not scan our own energy. And to me, that's not empowerment. To me, that is the opposite of empowerment. To me, that's crippling. It's telling me what I can't do, as opposed to, I believe it's time to go to the next level and evolve as quote unquote empaths, whomever think they fall into those categories of I can't be in crowds or I'm too sensitive, and they're labeled as all those things, which so, I think are beautiful
so,
things.
So how do you what are your primary recommendations for people to develop themselves?
So my primary recommendations are to first figure out what level you're at. I say that there's the unequipped empath, not immature empath, just unequipped, because we're all very mature at being empaths. Even people who think they're not empaths, we all lean into others' energy. It's just at varying levels. Number one, where are we? Do we even know if we are an empath? Number two, if we are an empath in training, if we don't really know what to do with it, then we may need tools such as protection to put around ourselves, maybe a bubble of protection, maybe some oils, essential oils to use, or some affirmations to use to help us for those people who have difficulty being in crowds. Crystals, whatever it is that people want to work with, I give them numerous tools in the book. That'd be level two. Level three is where I want to take us, and that would be to learn to visualize and move and transform or transmute, change, use alchemy, to change the energy, change the form of the energy into something we can use. If somebody's throwing, we think they're being negative to us. If I thought somebody was being rude to me or side jabbing me or something like that, then I could change that energy into some vitality I could use with visualization. And then I could use that for my empowerment as opposed to feeling down about it. So those are some of the steps I start with. I have over 50 exercises in the book on how to learn to scan our own energy to know how to do that.
Now, you know, when you talk about this, it's hard sometimes for people who have not, you know, considered this a separate idea. We assume that we are as we are, you know, raised as children, that we learn from our parents to care about other people. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about something much bigger.
Right. I mean, I think that hopefully we're raised to care about other people. I'm talking about a spectrum of caring. I would say that we're raised and people have, you know, we all have mirror. It starts with those mirror neurons where we all have mirror neurons that we can emulate. If one baby cries, they all cry. And so they, you know, and we can emulate caring and being upset. But then it goes all the way to the hypersensitive. And so it's a spectrum of how much we care. And I'm talking even anywhere along that spectrum of, you know, some of us care more about something than someone else. And so it's how do we deal with that energy instead of what's been going on really acutely for the past year of where everyone, I mean, it's been everywhere. It's been just cut that person off. Just, you know, if you're not getting along with them, just cut them off. Don't have anything to do with them. You know, you don't need to talk to that person ever again. And that's what I'm talking about, is what are we going to do? And I do believe in boundaries. I just want to say that because obviously if I worked with, I work a lot with battered women, and that's very important to me. So I want to disclaim that. I'm not talking about staying in abusive relationships, but I'm talking about healing those cords of connection. If we're all connected and we're all one, which I believe we are in some way, I believe there's really just 0 degrees of separation ultimately.
Well, if you find yourself feeling that way, that I just don't want to deal with that person. Okay, enough. What do you recommend? How do you?
Okay.
What should a person do? I can think of somebody.
So I'll give you. Here's a practical way.
Yeah, that's what we need.
I lived it during writing the book, right? Because when you write a book, especially this type of book, you get tested in it, right? So I got tested a lot in it. So if there's just somebody, and I would start with smaller things. I would start with irritants. To be honest, to practice this, I would start with things that irritate you more than the big, horrible things where you're in a big, big fight with someone. But let's say all of a sudden we're in an argument with somebody. Then you're going to first scan your energy. Just become aware of your own energy. Okay, what's mine? Is this headache mine, or is that person giving me a headache? Instead of just blaming that person all of a sudden for the headache. Okay, I didn't have this headache before. I am taking on the energy of this, and this is giving me a headache. And then I would step away, and I would literally use visualization techniques. Now, I'm not a psychologist, but I teach a lot of classes, and through being a lawyer so long, teaching law school, and, you know, having so many different human experiences with law, and now with so many healing sessions, what I do with clients is I say, step away, and practically, what I have them do is visualize. So I will have them, and a lot of people say, I can't visualize. Well, we can. I'll say, visualize, what does your car look like? Okay, and now change the color of your car to a different color. And they can do that. Or change the color of your kitchen. What does your kitchen sink look like? Now change it to a different color or something like that. And then, so practically, we're in an argument and with our friend, and we want to change, and we're really, really upset. And so we then imagine that situation, and we can, colors are great to work with, and it sounds so, oh, Pollyanna. Oh, yeah, like a color is going to really make me feel better. But it's something easy to visualize. So you can visualize that color, and you kind of almost visualize a cord of connection, like an etheric cord, or just a cord, a string going between you. And what does it look like? And it may, because you're in an argument, it may look like kind of gross. And then you can see, like, even imagine, like, okay, well, is it thick? Is it thin? Is it wispy? Is it yucky looking? Does it smell gross? Is it frayed? Because I'm really getting sick of this person. I don't want to be friends with her anymore or him. And then begin to change your part of it. You don't really have to worry about their end of it. You don't have to heal their end of it. It's just really getting back to making amends on your end, forgiving on your end, because you really don't have to worry about their end. If we would just worry about our end of everything, then there would be a lot more, it sounds corny, but it's sad that it sounds corny, a lot more love in a world right now. So I say visualize it and change the color to something brighter. Change the look of it to something different. And visualize changing. That's one of the exercises in the book. And that's probably one of the easiest ones to do. And it really works, because then all of a sudden you're becoming the observer to it, and you're not in it and not as angry. So it's changing the form of the energy. It's called transmutation. And it's that alchemy word. It's magic, quote-unquote.
Which is the title of the book, and which comes out on January 8th, and people can pre-order it. And also, once they get it, they can put in, you know, do some of your exercises. And mm-hmm. The name of the book is The Magic of Connection: Stop Cutting Cords and Learn to Transform Negative Energy to Live an Empowered Life. And I want to thank you so much, Michelle Welch, for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you. And it's always nice to find a lawyer who has empathy. I never did find one. I've had a few lawyers. But I'm just very, very happy that you joined us today on Joy on Paper. It's, you know, it's a beginning of 2021. We want a better year. And everyone, you can make it a better year by starting to think about how you can channel your empathy. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye now.
All right.
Bye. Okay. Well, yeah, boy, if I had a lawyer who cared about me, that's why I love Bill Larson. And we're going to have a commercial. And, you know, like, can we do the book buzz first? We have a very special book buzz. Devon Miller's February choice for a wonderful book that he recommends. And then I'm coming back with a wonderful guest, too, with Denise Casey. So let's go ahead and do the book buzz, okay?
Hey everyone, this is Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Club children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. It's that time of year, it's February, and that means love is in the air, and something that I myself love to do is draw. And that's what some of you guys are going to find yourself doing after reading this new book, Borders, written by children's literature enthusiast Chris Tomasi. In Chris's first published book, it's a book that asks the question, if kids were in charge of making the map of their country, and or world, what would it look like? How would our world be redesigned? In an effort of attempting to understand the world we live in, Chris aims to inspire kids to reimagine our world for the better. Illustrated by Mark Breyer, the book encourages kids to go ahead, pick up some paper and pen, and draw the world as they imagine it. As a kid at heart who loves to draw, I think you'll find me drawing the world the way I imagine it too. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest and with a wonderful, wonderful book. I'm so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Denise Casey. Hi, how are you?
Hey. It's so nice to talk to you. Boy, the world has a lot of stuff gone under the bridge since the last time we talked.
I know.
No kidding.
I know. And I can tell you now, this book, Valentino Will Die, is the second in the Bianca Dangerous Hollywood Mysteries, and it is set back there in the 1920s. Which now sounds so much better. So much. it's amazing this is such a wonderful book and a great way to escape into a different era, and we do want different 20s, and those 1920s were much more fun than what we're having today. And I hate to think of the films that they're going to be making about this, where everybody's going to be wearing a mask instead of the beautiful, beautiful clothes that and costumes and the beautiful faces of the people in Hollywood in the 1920s.
Yes, absolutely. Well, boy, it was a tremendous fun to write the book and escape back into the 20s. But, you know, at the time when this is 1927 that this book takes place. And at the time, you know, it was between the wars, and people were kind of cynical at the time, and they were kind of nihilistic, and that's why they were having so much fun. They were all out partying because, you know, eat, drink, and be merry for who knows what happens tomorrow. You know, that was their attitude in the 20s. But it was really tremendous fun to do all the research on what it's like to make silent movies, what that was like. That was really fun. And looking into the life of Rudolph Valentino, he was just an amazing person. So it was just a tremendously wonderful time to, like you said, to travel on the train and go to New York and be in Hollywood in the 1920s and meet all the famous people. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thanks to TCM, a lot of people are seeing silent movies, which we didn't really have the opportunity to, you know, see good quality silent movies before. And I know, you know, in this pandemic time, the silent movies I've been watching on TCM are so much better than most of the junk that they have on these streaming videos channels.
Yeah, it's funny. People don't think of silent movies as, I mean, you know, we've had the impression of all this jerky, you know, hokey, jerky filming and hokey scripts and everything, but it wasn't that way at all. They were really, some of them were really, really good. As a matter of fact, one of the ways I do the research for these books is watching silent movies. And I've seen dozens and dozens of them, and some of them are really wonderful. And it was watching the movies that gave me the idea to use those little title cards, inner title cards, instead of chapter headings for my chapters, you know, just like a silent movie. Some of the writing on those title cards was really clever and funny. So this really gave me a lot of ideas. And also it shows you what people look like, how they were thinking, and they were much more modern than you'd think, really.
And of course, for this book, you have Rudolph Valentino to deal with, and this is, you know, he was so gorgeous. You look back at the photos of him, and he was so beautiful. It must have been really fun to do this research.
Oh, it was. It was tremendous. And, you know, I thought I knew about... You know, I thought I knew more than I knew when I actually started looking into it, because I knew that he died young and that it was sudden. He died suddenly and he died young, and that there was tremendous grief all around the world when he died, because he was like the first, you know, sexiest man alive, and people were just wildly in love with him. And when he died all of a sudden, people committed suicide. There were people in the world who committed suicide because they just couldn't live without him to look at, you know. And so he became, you know, he was immortalized by dying young, like a lot of these young guys are. But he was on tour for a movie at the time. He was doing the movie tour for Son of the Sheik, which is his last movie. And he just fell sick in New York and was in the hospital for about a week. He had a perforated ulcer, but he was afraid of surgery, so he wouldn't let them cut him open until it was too late, and he was just full of...
Well, of course, when we get to your book, though, we don't know what's happening to him, actually, because in your book, it's wonderful. Now, we'll take a step back, because we have to talk a little bit about Bianca. The whole sort of story behind it, how we landed up in Hollywood, how little Blanche Tucker,
yes.
from a small town, Boynton, Oklahoma, and I guess you're writing from something that you know about, a little bit of the Oklahoma girl. We can still hear it in your voice. And
yes.
Bianca LaBelle.
Get rid of that, not like Blanche did.
That's right. You kept it, which is nice. But yes. We have Bianca LaBelle, and in this, it's a mystery. And set it up for the listeners so they understand exactly what's Bianca up to here.
Okay. Bianca ran away from home when she was 15 from her very large family. She's the eighth of 10 children in eastern Oklahoma, and she ran off with a very bad guy, and he told her he was going to take her to California and put her in the movies, and by the time they got to Arizona, she realized that wasn't his idea at all, so she managed an escape, and just by hook or by crook, fell backwards into... the movies. she ran across a silent movie that was being shot in the hills of Arizona, fell in with the movie people, ended up in California, and became a movie star herself. And she stars in a series of, like, Perils of Pauline adventures. And she plays a character called Bianca Dangerous and has all kinds of adventures in these movies. And she becomes very, very famous. So by 1927, this all happens in 1920. So by 1927, she's one of the great big stars of the world doing silent movies. And so she knows all of the big movie stars. And so finally, at the end, in 1927, she finally gets to make a movie with her friend, Rudolph Valentino, who she learned to dance. He was her dance teacher back in the early 20s. And they suddenly have both become very famous about the same time. And they're great friends, but they're not lovers, but they're great friends. And they both are like, they're like war buddies, because they're both very famous, and they both are kind of flummoxed to buy it. So while they're making this movie together, Rudy, he's not feeling very well. So Bianca invites him over to her house, so she can take care of him for a little while and make him some nice soup and stuff to soothe his tummy. And while they're sitting out by the pool having a chat one evening, he confesses that he's been getting death threats, that mysterious notes have been showing up in the oddest places, and they all say, Valentino will die. So he's kind of afraid. Doesn't know what to do about this. He doesn't trust the police. He doesn't trust much of anybody. But he tells Bianca about this, and she says, well, you know, I have a friend who is a private detective. We'll let him look into this. So he says, all right, well, that will be lovely. I have to go on tour now. So well, she contacts her friend, her private detective friend, and asks him to look into who may be sending Valentino these death threats. Rudy's on tour, and the next thing she knows, she's gone on to make another Bianca Dangerous movie. And while she's filming, her majordomo comes in, the man who runs her house, comes in and says, Rudy's agent just called and said, Rudy's fallen very ill in New York, and he wants you to come out there. He thinks he's been poisoned. So she drops everything, gets on the train, and goes to New York and talks to Rudy in the hospital, and Rudy is convinced that someone is trying to kill him.
And so from there, we get a nice mystery, and of course, we get Bianca is a fun character. Somebody that when readers start reading this series, they will really enjoy knowing more about her, because, as you say, she arrives in Hollywood like so many girls did in those days, but she's managed to hold it together and become a famous star. But still, there's a little bit of that Oklahoma. You know, you can take a girl out of Oklahoma, but there's a little bit of that common sense that's in Oklahoma.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, that's the old "you can take the girl out of Oklahoma" business. And whether she likes it or not, or knows it or not, she's still got that very self-sufficient
and of course
way about her.
The character is a spin-off from your very, very famous and well-known series, which, you know...
The Ella Fair Tucker
series, yeah. Of course, which, by the way, every time people will, you know, when I used to attend events, you know, writers' events and
right.
Speaking, and I used to speak in front
the
of people in those
yeah.
good old days. I just, can you believe it? I haven't, you know, attended one event, BoucherCon, you know, I never went to other events, I never went to. But I used to love almost weekly going to writers' meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I always said, you know, the people will say, you know, I'm working on a book, I'll ask them the title, and they'll have different things. And then I said, I always tell them, now, if you want the best title in the world, the best, go back to the very first LFR Tucker book by Denise Casey, and it's called The Old Buzzard Had It Coming. And
yes.
Even when I say it, I start laughing because that has to be, I cannot think of a better title than that book.
Oh, you know, that book, that is an evergreen book. That came out in 2005, and that book is still just sells like crazy. Because that's my mother, that title. My mother gave me that idea, and she didn't even know it. But I was trying to think of a title for my very first book, and I wanted something that was catchy because, you know, nobody ever heard of me and didn't know anything about me. It was my first book. And so I wanted a catchy title, and I kept thinking, well, you know, the person that gets killed in that is a horrible person. So I thought, well, he had it coming. And I thought, well, that's not catchy enough. But just by a fluke, I was talking to my mother on the phone. She lived in an apartment complex, a retirement complex, and she had a downstairs neighbor who was kind of an old roue. And I asked her, well, how's Howard doing? And she said, well, you know what? I think that old buzzard has a girlfriend. And I thought, that's it, the old buzzard. The old buzzard had it coming. And I thought, well, they'll probably change it because publishers always change your titles. But they didn't.
And it's a good thing they didn't, because I don't know if there's a book award for the best title, but I think you should win it. Really, it is the best. You never forget it.
Thank you.
And if you see it,
the only problem is now it's hard to come up with anything that's anywhere near that good.
I know you can't top that one.
I know.
Because if you're walking down, if the days, you know, when we used to stroll through bookstores, that title, you'd stop. You'd have to get it just, you know. And I can see why it still sells very well, and it'll continue to. Because of course, you capture this Oklahoma family, and you and Ella Fair Tucker, who solves mysteries too. So it's in the blood, I guess.
Yep.
And Blanche, there in Hollywood, gets to do sort of follow in her mother's footsteps on solving crimes. But,
yep.
You know, and she's just that kind of a person that you know, we want her to be successful. We want her to be happy. And
yep.
You've created a really great character with her.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel like she ended up getting everything she wanted. And then in the end, she found out, you know, it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. So, and she's also like her mother in that she has a lot of empathy. And when people are afraid or hurting or something like that, she just desperately wants to figure out some way to help them. And I think that was the way that Alifair is, too. So I think she got that from her mother as well. So she's a very empathetic character with some regret because she ran away from home and hurt her mother's feelings, you know. And and yet, she's very rich and very famous and very beautiful, and so she ended up kind of getting everything she wants, but life is complicated, you know?
Yeah, it is. But it's not bad that she gets to make interesting movies.
Right.
And of course, you, it's not bad for you because you get to research these clothes and the buildings and the, you write so... You take us to Hollywood in those days, and that's really
that
right now we need that escape. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, you know, one thing that was really fun for me to learn about making movies, especially early in the 20s. By the 1927, film had really improved a whole lot, but in the 19-teens and the early 20s, the quality of film was such that people had to wear really heavy makeup in order for their faces to show up. And that's why they have, in the 20s, that's why the eye makeup was so big, was because in the movies they had to wear a lot of eye makeup just in order for their eyes to show up. And that got to be the fashion. Because all the movie star ladies had lots and lots of eye makeup on, so that got to be the fashion all over the world. Also, they couldn't show blue-eyed people. their eyes would disappear. So people with pale blue eyes couldn't really be in the early silent movies because they didn't have any eyes. Their eyes would disappear. So I thought, you know, stuff like that is really interesting to me. You know, who would think?
Exactly. Well, I think, you know, if you set a book somewhere and you have to do a lot of research, that is one of the best places in the world to set a book in Hollywood in the 1920s with all those beautiful people. And, of course, we're heading up into the time where the talkies are going to be coming.
That's just what I was going to say.
I was going to say.
1927 is the very first talkie, and so that's going to be...
I was going to say the next book. I knew it was going to be a talkie because
Well, the book after the next. I've already finished the next book, you know, and it's still silent. It's at the end of 1927, so we're just coming up on it now. I'm just getting ready to start the talkies book now.
Wow. Well, you've really come out with a wonderful new series. You know, sometimes people have a great series, a long run like you had with Alifair Tucker, and then you don't know where to go. You don't want to keep going.
Right.
But you spun off this daughter, and you spun her off to the right place.
And it's so different. It really gave me a perk, you know, to try and come up with something different. Even the voice is different because it's a different place and time, and the people are different. So it has a more sort of rat-a-tat.
Yeah, everything, the dialogue, the pacing is great. And everybody, if you want to find out who is trying to kill the world's greatest lover, you have to get Valentino Will Die. It's a Bianca Dangerous Hollywood mystery. This is book two, and you will enjoy it. And then when you finish that, you can go on back to book one and just enjoy the whole thing, because there's a wonderful way to escape. And the first book was The Wrong Girl, and you can just... Get into Hollywood and get into that vibe. And it's also fun, you know, it's amazing sometimes when you go to Hollywood and you still see 1920s buildings there. You know, it's nice to look it up. Well, I want to thank you so much. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yeah, well, my website is Donis Casey, that's DONISCASEY .com. And I'm going to be doing a bunch of book giveaways over the next few months of the Alifair books, as a matter of fact, and just so you can kind of get the whole background, get Blanche's whole background in it. And so if you want to, also I have excerpts of all my books on my website, so you could even read an excerpt of Valentino Will Die if you wanted to on my website.
Oh, okay. Well, Donis, it's so nice to talk to you. It's always a pleasure to read your books, all of them, and go back and read them.
Thank you so much, and I hope I can talk to you again next year, and you take care and be safe.
Okay, you too. I don't know what the situation... I can't deal with the news too much, but I hope things aren't as bad in Oklahoma. They were bad here. But take care of yourself and just have fun. You know, the nice thing about being a writer is you don't mind staying in and doing research.
That's right. So, at least I have something to do.
Oh,
that's right.
And I think you have a lot to do because you do great research and you bring it all seamlessly into the books. And everyone, you will enjoy Valentino Will Die. And again, thank you, Donis, for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you, Patsy.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye now. Oh, she's nice. I love these books. It is... I just like these books set nowadays, because who wants to be in 2021? Even 2020 was bad enough. 2021 doesn't look like it's that much better. So it's nice to go back in time. And I love Donis Casey's books, but I also love L.A. Chandler's books. And she also has books set, you know, set back then, 1920s, 1930s. Well, we were for a while thinking those were bad old days. They look like the good old days compared to what we have today. And it's nice to escape. And both of these authors, I think you will enjoy Dennis Casey and L.A. Chandler's books are great. And, just for a few minutes, I want to talk, empathy. It's just funny. Denise mentioned the word empathy. And one of the things that recently I've been reading a lot about the Korean War, which is driving me crazy because I'm so upset about the Korean War. As if I don't have other things to be upset about. The Korean War is bothering me. And it's a little bit cold here in Florida. I mean, we're talking 40 degrees, nothing compared to what people have up north. And I'm suffering at 40 degrees. I can't stand it. And I keep thinking about how our soldiers suffered. People don't know how very, very cold Korea was. And that our men were fighting in negative degrees, negative 15 degrees. Our men were fighting there. And it was just terrible. And I'm suffering because of them. But when I'm cold outside, I just try to remember what they were going through. And not forget. I don't want to forget them because they talk about the Korean War as being a forgotten war. And for some reason, it just struck me when I was reading, I read so much, but when I read about what they went through and the terrible things they went through, all because of absolute stupidity and all because so many people lied to us, we should never have been in Korea. And it just drives me crazy that all these people suffered and died for because we were not told the truth at all about the situation and how weak China was. And really, this war was ridiculous. The more you read about it, the more you realize it was an absolute ridiculous war. And it's just heartbreaking. So empathy. I don't need crystal rocks to make me feel emphatic, but I do just enjoy listening to people and talking to people. And I do hope that, I appreciate also, I wanted to thank all of you who have sent me emails. One with questions for Bill Larson, who's going to be on later this month, about intellectual property. Oh, you do have to protect it. I've heard some terrible cases recently. But just everybody, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You don't know, and you won't if you don't start writing. And say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And I have a lot of empathy for him. He has to deal with a lot of things. He's long suffering. And anyway, I really think, he's saluting me because I am a generalissimo. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Stay warm wherever you are. The weather's crazy. And just read a good book and start writing. Bye-bye now.